next case on our calendar is the State of Ohio Appellant versus Jerry Griffin, Jr. For the State of Ohio, Ms. Schrimmer.
Thank you, Justice Piper. May it please the Court. If I may, I'd like to please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
For two key reasons, only a court of common pleas and not the court of claims can determine whether a person was wrongfully imprisoned based on procedural error. First, the court of claims is a court of limited jurisdiction. It can only do that which the General Assembly has explicitly authorized it to do. And nothing in the wrongful imprisonment statute or anywhere else authorizes the Court of Claims to adjudicate the declaratory phase of wrongful imprisonment suits. It only has authority to determine the subsequent damages action. Second, the full text of the wrongful imprisonment statute, 2743-48, confirms that the General Assembly maintained the two-step process even after the 2003 amendments. Turning to the first issue.
I don't recall. Would those all be in Franklin County in the Common Pleas Court, or are they in?
No, Your Honor. The declaratory phase are handled by the Common Pleas Courts in the
county where the defendant was sentenced originally.
Correct. Right. Correct. And the Court of Claims, obviously here,
right,
handles the damages phase.
So the state is in the unique position of, instead of trying to gather all those cases in Columbus, arguing we should spread around the wealth in this case.
As to the declaratory phase, it makes eminent sense, I think, for the Common Pleas Courts to determine the declaratory phase. That phase is steeped in issues relating to criminal law, the question of who is a wrongfully imprisoned individual, which is set forth, the definition, the five-part definition, which is set forth in the statute, involves multiple criminal law-related determinations. The question of what procedural error is, it is not statutorily defined, and so that is something that will be fleshed out by the lower courts, and we think it makes eminent sense and much more sense for the Common Pleas Courts to resolve those questions than the Court of Claims, which is an exclusively civil court that was established to hear only civil actions for money damages against the state. And in terms of the first part of the analysis, the Court of Claims is a creature of statute, so we can only hear that which, and it's a court of limited jurisdiction. So it can't hear the declaratory phase because the General Assembly has never said that it could. And we can zoom in, I think, pretty quickly on the error in the 10th District's decision if the Court looks to paragraphs 10 through 15 of the 10th District's opinion, where in paragraph after paragraph, the 10th District walks through the wrongful imprisonment statute and notes that each provision that it's analyzing, the 10th District says, well, this doesn't prevent the Court of Claims from making the determination of wrongful imprisonment, nor does this prevent the Court of Claims from issuing the declaration of wrongful imprisonment. And that's the wrong answer, Your Honors, because it asks the wrong question. When it comes to the Court of Claims, we don't ask, is there anything that prevents the Court of Claims from hearing the declaratory phase? We have to ask, is there any explicit authority authorizing it to hear that phase? And the answer is no. Subsection D of the wrongful imprisonment statute is the jurisdictional provision in the statute, and it only authorizes the Court of Claims to hear a quote-unquote suit for money damages, or a suit for monetary claims. It doesn't authorize it, nor does anywhere else in the statute authorize the Court of Claims to hear the declaratory phase. And so, as to part one of the analysis, I think that's the easy part of this. Case, which involves an admittedly perhaps inartful statute. But that, I think, is the easy part, that the Court of Claims cannot hear the declaratory phase. So then the question is, where is that declaratory phase heard? And we think in other places in the statute, it makes clear that the General Assembly intended to preserve the two-step process and to have the Common Pleas Court adjudicate that declaratory phase. And that appears in multiple provisions. We have provision B1, which contemplates the Common Pleas Court, after it determines that an individual is a wrongfully imprisoned person, notifying that individual that they can then go to the Court of Claims to seek money damages. We have section B2 that contemplates the Court of Common Pleas, after it issues a determination, notifying the clerk of the Court of Claims that this individual is on his way to file a suit for money damages. We have subsection E1 of the wrongful imprisonment statute, the evidentiary provision, that contemplates that the only evidence needed for the Court of Claims to begin the process of ascertaining damages is to have in hand a certified copy of the determination from the Court of Common Pleas. And then we have subsection H, which is the statute of limitations provision, which contemplates that that an action for damages in the Court of Claims only begins to run once the determination by the Common Pleas Court as to wrongful imprisonment, has been issued. And so in all of those provisions, what we see is the General Assembly contemplating and maintaining that two-step process. And none of those provisions, importantly, distinguish between claims grounded in actual innocence or procedural error.
Ms. Schirmer, before you run out of time, I just want to ask you a question about 230502. It indicates that the Common Pleas Court has exclusive original jurisdiction to hear and determine an action for wrongful imprisonment, but it says commenced by an individual who satisfies divisions A1 to A4 of 2743-48. No reference to A5. If I understand Mr. Griffith's position, there's been an amendment to that fifth, that it talks about subsequent to sentencing, an error has occurred in the procedure resulting in the individual's release. And the essence of the argument he's making, I think, is that's A5, and there's nothing that gives the Common Pleas Court authority to make that determination on an A5 in this amendment. That must land in the Court of Claims. That's what his argument is.
Correct. That is what his argument is.
What's your response to his position?
Sure. Our response to that is this, Your Honor, that it's true that neither A5 nor 230502 were amended in 2003 to tie in the procedural error, the recognition that procedural error is now a basis for wrongful imprisonment. But our position on that is that it doesn't matter, that those provisions don't answer the question of where the declaratory phase is heard. And first, we have to do the process of elimination, which is, one, we can't repose that determination in the Court of Claims simply by default, because there's nothing that says that they affirmatively should be in the Common Pleas Court in subsection A5 or in 230502.
But there's no specific grant of authority to hear the A5 claim, exclusive original jurisdiction in the Common Pleas Court in 230502.
What we have, though, in through all the other parts of the wrongful imprisonment statute, though, Your Honor, is an instruction that the Court of Claims can only hear the damages action, and B, instructions in multiple places in the multiple provisions I just mentioned that do contemplate the Common Pleas Court making the determination of who is a wrongfully imprisoned individual. And we know from subsection A that who is a wrongfully imprisoned individual involves the factors in A1 through 5. And I think that 230502 is not necessary for us to consider to resolve this issue, and that it's ultimately a belt and suspenders provision, because we don't need a special hall pass to go to the Common Pleas Court for it to adjudicate a declaratory claim. It has jurisdiction to adjudicate declaratory claims through the General Declaratory Judgment Act, 2721-02.
Ms. Schirmer, are you saying that A5 still requires a declaratory judgment action? Because it seemed to me, as I read it, and I may not be on the same wavelength here, is that A5 was suggesting that there may be some situations where there was an error in the procedure, the Common Pleas Court has determined that the individual was not convicted rightfully. But it sounds as though this takes it out of the declaratory judgment action, so you have another method to get to the Court of Claims. Am I misreading that?
I think so, respectfully, Your Honor. I think that to focus narrowly, I think to focus narrowly on A5 is to miss the other provisions in the statute. And the state concedes that if this statute were crafted in a way that we think vindicates what we do think the General Assembly's intent was, and we do think the General Assembly's intent is apparent from the whole and the entirety of the statute, but we do certainly agree that if it were done better, then A5 would have been amended as well, in the same way that we have instruction manuals for things that we assemble and often sit on the floor and wish they were written better. But I don't think it means that at the end of the day we don't have a whole that we can work with that reflects the intent of the General Assembly to maintain a declaratory phase. And I would point the Court again back to, in addition to the provisions I mentioned before that still contemplate that two-part process, also to look to, for instance, subsection D again, which is the jurisdictional provision. And it says, Court of Claims can only hear the damages action. And I do think that that just resolves exactly what the scope of the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims
is. So you're saying you must always first have a declaratory judgment action in the Court of Common Pleas.
Correct. And that makes sense, because when we look at what the factors are in subsection A for what a wrongfully imprisoned individual is, it's not necessarily a straightforward affair. There, in addition, before you even get to the actual innocence or procedural error questions in A5, there are four other factors that could perhaps be just as vexing. The question of whether the individual can seek further appeal, the question of whether the prosecutor can appeal, the question of whether the prosecutor can bring further charges. All of those questions, they will involve things like double jeopardy analysis, allied offenses analysis, and even for courts that work in those arenas all the time, those legal criminal law questions prove complicated and thorny. And there's no question, I think, that the Common Pleas courts are the proper courts to handle those questions, and that the Court of Claims, as an exclusively civil court, is not. And I would also point out, Justice Pfeiffer alluded to it a little bit, but some of the logistical issues attendant to suggesting that the Court of Claims should hear the declaratory phase. You have these issues that are the criminal law issues are the declaratory phase is defended by the prosecutors. They would have to all travel to Columbus, to the Court of Claims. All the witnesses, documents, evidence are located back in the home Court of Common Pleas. So it would be extremely inefficient for them to handle that there. We also have then an imbalance with statutes of limitations that for actual, if we say that actual innocence claims belong in Common Pleas, but procedural error-based declarations belong in Court of Claims, you'll have a 6-year statute of limitations for the declarations in one context and a 2-year statute of limitations in another context. And I'd also point out, as to the plaintiff's interest, I have yet to see what interest a plaintiff would have in appearing in the Court of Claims to have a declaratory phase adjudicated there. A, you have the statute of limitations problem, but you also have the problem presented by the General Court of Claims statute 2743.02, which provides that once you file an action in the Court of Claims, you waive all other actions that you might have against state officers or employees arising from the same set of circumstances. So if a plaintiff goes into the Court of Claims seeking a declaration based on procedural error and loses for whatever reason at all, they have waived whatever other claims that they might have, a 1983 claim, a malicious prosecution claim, a wrongful prosecution type of claim. So it's very hard to see what the possible interest of a plaintiff would be and therefore what the intent of the General Assembly would be in doing that. And we do think that if you read the statute in its entirety, that it absolutely vindicates the continuation of the two-step process, and that we don't need to be concerned about A5 and 2305.02 because courts of common pleas have jurisdiction over declaratory judgments through the Declaratory Judgment Act.
You've got 2 minutes.
And
you wanted three. So.
I'll reserve the rest of my time if there aren't
further
questions.
All right,
thank you.
Mr. Slicer, on behalf of Jerry Griffith.
Good morning to the court. I'd first like to start off with the statement that the state states that Court of Claims cannot hear declaratory judgments. If we take a look at Ohio Revised Code 2743.032, it specifically states, if the claimant in a civil action, as described in A1 of this section, also files a declaratory judgment, injunctive relief, or other equitable relief against the state that arises out of the same set of, out of the same circumstances that gives rise to the civil action described in A1 of this section, the Court of Claims has exclusive original jurisdiction to hear and determine that claim in that civil action. It's my contention, it's our contention, that when you're looking at A5 under that wrongful imprisonment statute, which is 2743.48, A5 has two different provisions that you can file a claim under. One is that you can file for a determination in the Common Pleas Court to determine or have a determination that the defendant or the accused is either innocent or the crime never happened. The other section is it's the procedural error. It doesn't say in there in that A5 section that the court has to make that determination. And in accordance with this statute, if the case is filed with the Court of Claims under that A5, we'll call it the subsection 1, then the Court of Claims does have exclusive jurisdiction or at least some jurisdiction to make a determination of that declaratory judgment as it arises out of that civil action.
Counsel, I see three practical issues, maybe more so than legal, for a plaintiff. One is the waiver issue presented in that filing in Court of Claims, you waive other claims. The other, statute of limitations. And the third is you have a court that doesn't have any criminal expertise to really, really analyze whether there was a procedural error or not, unless you hope to find that established otherwise. Why would you seek to go first to the Court of Claims? What rationale would that, what benefit would that be?
I guess it would be if the analysis was done before you filed with the Court of Claims that all the other, like the 1983 claims and whatever claims you may have don't exist, or if the defendant decides that he does not want to pursue those avenues, then the Court of Claims may be the last alternative.
Okay, then that leads me to my next question. If we rule in your favor and find that A5 requires you go to the Court of Claims, are you not cutting off a lot of other defendants' ability to pursue a different course of action? In other words, it's sort of the Foster case. You know, you kill the trees for the forest, and you don't see the whole picture of what you're trying to ask for. Are you not cutting off somebody else who would rather go to the Court of Claims because they have a longer statute of limitations, they have other claims they want to bring for 1983 actions, and now you've foreclosed all those? Is that really what you want us to rule?
Well, that's not the intent of what the argument is, but the intent would be to give the defendant an avenue to file with the Court of Claims if that's the route he chooses to file.
You're saying that they could do either?
I don't see why they couldn't. I mean, if the statute is designed that says that the Common Pleas has the jurisdiction, but it also indicates that the Court of Claims can also decide that declaratory judgment issue.
So you would say that the defendant has the choice under the way the statute's worded to go to Common Pleas or Court of Claims?
I think the way that it's worded that the defendant can choose to go to either right now. And I don't. The way that it's written, to answer your question, yes.
Well, counsel, under 230502, that statute was not amended, and it says the Court of Common Pleas has exclusive original jurisdiction in actions under A1 through 4. It specifically does not mention A5. So, I mean, the argument would be the defendant has to go to Common Pleas on the first four points, but on the fifth option, it has the choice between the two.
Correct. Okay. And I would look at A5 and also state that the only thing in A5 states that the court, and if we look at A5.
You're dividing A5 into two sections.
Yes.
The first part says an error in procedure resulting in the individual's release can be venued in the Court of Claims for an original determination and a damages award.
Correct.
The other part of A5 requires a determination by a court of common pleas that the offense of which he was found guilty was not committed by him or was not committed by any person. That mandates it go to the Common Pleas Court if you're proceeding under the second portion of A5.
Correct.
Is that your view?
Yes.
So there's only one avenue that your reading of A5 permits an automatic declaration of the Court of Claims.
It provides an avenue for the person to file in the court of claims, yes.
Only in the first portion of A-5.
Yes.
In all the others, the defendant would be required to go to the common pleas court.
Yes. That's my reading of the statute, yes.
Did you say required to go to the common pleas? I thought you, when you answered Justice Lanzinger's, you said that there's the ability to choose.
Well, I mean, the way that I'm looking at the statute is if you have a procedural error, you could choose to file in the court of claims. But if there is a if you're trying to seek a determination pursuant to the statute that you're innocent of the crime or that the crime never happened at all, according to A-5, then you have to go to the common pleas. There's no choice there at that point in time.
So the procedural determination would be made in the court of claims, whether or not this is a procedural error. Now, where's that determination come in?
The determination for what? Whether there's a procedural error?
Right.
I guess my contention would be, especially in the Griffith case, is there would be a court of appeals decision that says, basically in the criminal case, that there's a procedural error that caused the reversal of the decision, that caused the reversal and dismissal of the charge.
Is that then an automatic equivalent to the procedural error that is referenced in this statute?
I believe so.
It doesn't require an additional determination. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying, yes.
You said resulted in a reversal of the decision, but the statute says resulted in the individual's release, which would imply that there had been some commitment of some point.
Correct.
And the defendant had been discharged from custody or discharged from the court.
Correct.
And only in that circumstance can the defendant proceed in the court of claims with some presumable judgment of some court indicating that as a result of a due process or other procedural violation, the individual has now been released and he's now seeking a determination of damages from the court of claims.
That is correct.
And that's the only circumstance in your reading on which the action can be filed in the first instance in the court of claims.
Correct.
So, for example, if the court of appeals held that the speedy trial rights were violated and that the defendant, therefore, is ordered released, you would claim that you could take that order from the Court of Appeals and go straight to the Court of Claims and recover?
On the basis of a procedural error, yes. Not on the basis that the person was either innocent of the crime or the crime never occurred.
So you could have a confession, you could have a speedy trial violation, and you could have wrongful recovery for imprisonment.
Under the procedural error provision of A-5, yes. The state also indicates that there's some legislative history from the General Assembly which the court should look into in trying to interpret some ambiguous definition of the statute. As we briefed in our brief and we stated in our arguments that the statute is very unambiguous. A-5 sets out two different avenues for a defendant to file a claim in this case. One is to file a determination. The other is to file a request based on an error, a procedural error. To the basic reading of the statute, and to somebody who's just reading it, there's no ambiguity in that statute.
Well, counsel, I have another question about the response you gave to, I believe, Justice Stratton. If there's a determination of a violation of the speedy trial provisions, and the appellate court releases the prisoner because he has to be in custody for this to even be relevant, then you say you would take that determination from the appellate court and go right to the court of claims.
Yes.
And you would then shut off all other causes of action that the prisoner could pursue then by going to that court of claims, correct?
I think that would have to be a case-by-case determination.
Well, if you're saying it's procedural,
yeah,
then you're saying it has to go to the court of claims. You're not saying if you've got a procedural error, you've got an option to go to the common pleas court, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's what you said. So if you find that the speedy trial was the activity on behalf of the prosecutor or whomever was a 1983 violation that precipitated this speedy trial violation, you would preclude your client then from attacking or going after based on 1983, because you're saying, I'm going to take that appellate decision and I'm going to go right to the Court of Claims and I'm going to waive all other claims that my client might have against the prosecutor or whatever. Is that right?
I guess I'm not trying to create a waiver of all those other rights that he may have, and perhaps it's more...
Well, isn't that the theory when you go to the Court of Claims?
Yes, it is that theory, but...
Well, how can you have both sides? You know, you want it all. You want your cake and you want to eat it, too. And how do you do that here?
I guess the only way would be to recreate the statute and put in there that...
To recreate the statute?
Well, I'm not asking
not
this court
to do that.
I'm not asking this court to do that. And what I'm saying is perhaps the legislature needs to look at that, but that's for another day and time.
Right, because what I'm trying to figure out is, would the legislature be following your logic and saying, you know, that's a pretty good thing to be able to limit. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that based on 1 through 4 and all of the, you know, these statutes taken together, that was their intent, is to preclude recovery. So you're kind of maybe working against the interest of maybe not your client, but every other wrongfully imprisoned defendant that comes along.
And perhaps perhaps the intent was to, if you're going to do an or on a procedural area, the intent is to either give the defendant an option to file for a determination or go to the Court of Claims. But I understand what you're asking me.
Mr. Slicer, the question I want to follow up with on what I was inquiring about your argument earlier, I understand the A5 portion of the argument that you think can be venued directly in the Court of Claims. But 274348 says, a wrongfully imprisoned individual means an individual who satisfies each of the following, and you must go through 1 through 4 before you get to 5. Who makes the determination about arguments, about the evidence raised in satisfying arguments 1 through 4? Is it your view that the Court of Claims can do that, or is it your position that the Court of Common Pleas must do that?
Perhaps I can answer in this fashion. My reading of the statute would say that the Court of Claims can make the determinations 1 through 4.
Can?
They can. I mean, because you're going to file that declaratory action under procedural error in the Court of Claims.
But the procedural error is only a portion of 5, and you admit the second portion of 5 must be determined by a common pleas court.
Yes. But the second portion of the whole statute, the only time that the Court of Common Pleas is ever mentioned in the statute to make a determination is for that limited purpose under A5.
So it's your view that a court of claims on a procedural issue where the individual has been released from incarceration can determine 274348, 1 through 4, and the first portion of 5.
Yes.
Okay. I think I understand your argument.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Slicer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Ms. Trimmer, you have a little less than 2 minutes.
Okay. I'll try to address all the points. I think there are 4 minutes.
You don't have to cover them all.
Well, I'll try to iron it out. Let me just first clarify one thing that came up. One is that you can't just take a judgment in hand from the appeal in a criminal case and walk over to the Court of Claims and say, now I have my procedural error, let's talk about damages. There is a complicated statutory analysis that 274348 has set up to determine whether someone is wrongfully imprisoned. And the question of what procedural error is not as simple as getting in hand something that says, hey, there's been a Speedy Trial Act violation. We don't know that a Speedy Trial Act violation is a procedural error. You can read subsection A5, and it's not even clear that it contemplates procedural error as being something at all that could be trial error, because it's talking about things that are subsequent to sentencing and so forth. So this all has to be fleshed out, and it hasn't been fleshed out yet. So I don't think there's anything at all that allows someone to take a judgment from the criminal appeal and walk over to the Court of Claims. In addition to that, you also, of course, have to satisfy the four other criteria under A, and those are evaluations that also involve issues steeped in criminal law. Going to Justice O'Donnell's concern in terms of A5 and how to read A5, I think the most important thing about A5 is that there's nothing about A5 that we can read that authorizes the Court of Claims to hear anything. At best, what you can say about A5 is that it's silent about procedural error. But because the Court of Claims is a court of limited jurisdiction, we can't parlay that silence into a default positioning of the declaration about procedural error into the Court of Claims. So I think the other sections of the statute confirm that it still has to be made by a court of common pleas, and not to complicate matters, or if the court doesn't feel satisfied that there's enough authority to put it into the common pleas court, then I think it would have to declare that the General Assembly created a cause of action with no home, and that those are really the two options, that the declaratory phase goes in the Court of Common Pleas or that it creates no home. Now, the state's position is that, and I think the court's position, too, is that the court should read statutes to vindicate the intent of the General Assembly, and clearly the intent of the General Assembly here was to create a basis for a claim of wrongful imprisonment grounded in procedural error, and so allowing that declaration to be heard there is what should be done. And
Whoa. You're done.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I see that now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.